Is this a hymn? Is this a love song? Something ancient by a poet? Maybe Hafiz, maybe Rumi. Is he singing about two hearts searching in the darkness? Or is he singing about fishing? The tune seems sad, but are the words sad? What's he saying? Is he praying? And why does it get to me? Is he lonely? Maybe reaching out for someone. Look at me, maybe I'm the one who's fishing. Every day you stare to the west, to the south. You can see for miles, but things never change. Then honey in your ears, spice in your mouth. Nothing's as surprising as the taste of something strange.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios. This week on Broadway for Sunday, February 18th, 2018. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peta Felicia, Jan Simpson, and Julie Musbach. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many of the places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Jan Simpson. Jan is the director of Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism. Also writes for TDF Stages, American Theater, and has her own blog at Broadway and Me. Good morning, Jan.
Morning.
Good morning. Also joining us is Julie Musbach. Julie is a full-time writer and editor for Broadway World. Her previous work includes the assistant publicist to companies such as the Paper Mill Playhouse, the Drama League, and art department assistant for Fox Studios Australia on Rake, a 2013 film starring Richard Roxburgh. Thanks for joining us, Julie.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. Michael's not with us today. He is in Washington, D.C., seeing the Kennedy Center production of Chess and A West Side Story, and he's going to be back next week to talk with us. Also, Debbie Schrager from the D.C. area, one of our listeners, is also going to join us next week to talk about the Chess concert as well. So we look forward to that. With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Katrina Lenk is joining us by telephone. Broadway fans know Katrina, of course, from the runaway hit The Band's Visit. We've also seen her in Indecent, Once, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. We're going to have to hit that. And The Miracle Worker. And something else in my research. You did a special concert called Barack on Broadway, and how I miss those days.
Oh my goodness.
and last year you were the recipient of a Theater World Dorothy Loudon Award for Excellence, and we have somebody connected with Theater World here, don't we now? So thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us. So tell
us, my pleasure.
Tell us this whole Band's Visit ride. How long have you been on this ride?
Since last year, we had like a workshop in maybe July, and then did the off-Broadway production in the winter, and then now we're doing the on-Broadway production, which is it's pretty exciting.
We've heard that Band's Visit's been in the works for so long. So you just joined it for the just before Atlantic Theater Company last year.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. What I was going to say is there are very few people, of course, who can say that in 1 year, in the same calendar year, that there was an appearance in a Broadway play as well as a Broadway musical. And this must be an astonishing thing for you, considering the fact that you've had to work your way up in your career. I mean, you took over in Spider-Man. You took over in Once. You were an understudy in The Miracle Worker. I mean, wow. When success happens, it happens very quickly, doesn't it?
Yes, this is how I respond to this question. Like, I don't know what to say. It still feels overwhelming and strange. And with both Indecent and Band's Visit, you know, Indecent was an even longer process. It was 2 years of doing it, you know, in various places like at Yale and La Jolla, and then off Broadway at the Vineyard. And we had no idea that it would catch fire the way that it did. And we were just doing this project because we all loved it. And it just, it somehow kept moving forward and people responded to it. And it was kind of similar with Band's Visit. Like when we started, we, of course, we loved the project, but didn't, you never really know how the people are going to respond to it who can come to see the show. So again, we were just also like, oh yay, everyone likes it too. And so, yeah, it's a really nice set of coincidences, I got to say.
All right. Now, was there ever a possibility that you might not be able to do both shows? After all, Indecent could have run longer and should have. And would you have had to have made a decision there, I would imagine. And what decision would you have made?
Thank God I did not have to make that decision.
Sure.
So it all worked out great. Yeah, so I'm not even going to drag myself nuts with that.
Fine.
So now you have the Band's Visit cash recording coming out. I think that's coming out this week or next week. When did you guys get into the studio to record that, and what's this schedule been like for you?
We went in the Monday after we opened. The Sunday and Monday after we opened. So we were all like, what? Kind of, you know, exhausted from the whole many, many weeks leading up to opening. And, but it was a really fun 2 days in the studio to all kind of still be together and get to put the music down together. So it was a really neat thing to get to do. And it's been, the schedule since then has been also kind of very busy. Just there's always things to be doing. yeah.
Sure. You know, you have your 10 out of 12s a couple of weeks leading into opening night, and then you do this cast recording. Did you, were there changes that you had between Atlantic Theater Company and Broadway that you had to... that fine-tuning that was happening in between the two productions?
Yeah, I'd say there weren't like massive changes, but more fine-tuning, like you say. And I know there were certain things technically that we weren't able to accomplish in the time we had off Broadway that David Cromer, our director, was very excited about actually getting to do once we moved to a larger space with more time. And so there...
Can you give us an example of one?
Sure. There's a turntable that we use throughout the production. And off-Broadway, it was quite tricky because we didn't have, in the rehearsals leading up to the production, we had no turntable, like, in the rehearsal room. So it was a lot of, like, imagining, I guess I'll be rotated over here by this point. I don't know. So there was so much of the play that we couldn't really quite stage until we got into the theater. And then we only had, like, 2 weeks before we had to have an audience. So we, like the final song, Answer Me, we never really quite got it to how we wanted it, with the turntable and the lighting and all this stuff. So that has been, I think maybe that might've changed the most, from the off-Broadway to this one. Now there's this beautiful lighting that happens and these visuals and the turntable, it's just, it's quite stunning. So like things like that. We also, we added an additional musician to the Alexandria Ceremonial Police Orchestra, Osama Farouk, who's plays the darbuki, the drum. And he's been added since the off-Broadway production. He's fantastic. And it's great to have
him on
stage more. Yes, he's really, and he loves to play. He loves music so much and loves to play so much and is just so generous with it, like always like playing and showing us things. And yeah, he's wonderful. And just the fact that the musicians are now, like the band is now on stage more and kind of within the storytelling of the piece more than off-Broadway. They were kind of like pushed into the upper corner or like completely disappeared into the pit. So now they're definitely more present, which is great.
So you've had other, Once was very similar in that respect. You've had other experiences along those lines, bringing that music up on stage, and it's such an integral part of the story. We talked
yeah, to Andy, yeah.
We talked to Andrew Polk last week or the week before, and he brought us his stories about the turntable as well, about in rehearsal, in rehearsal, just imagining the turntable, and then, you know, kind of at Atlantic Theater Company, the first couple of performances, learning the turntable while you had live audiences.
Yes.
You are no stranger to learning on the stage. In our rundown before, we mentioned that you did Spider-Man. So can you give us any insight into, you know, a couple of years reflection into what it was like to do Turn Off the Dark?
I had a fantastic time doing that show. I was just over the moon. I really love flying. And, you know, anytime I can hang from the rafters, I'm all over it. So that was really fun. And the time I was there, there was no drama. You know, there was no one. Yeah. I know there's lots of press always about people getting hurt. And in the time I was there, there was nothing like that. It was like a well-oiled machine. Everyone knew what was going on. And it was a great cast. It took me a really long time to not be so horribly nervous because the pressure that, oh my God, people are paying so much for these tickets and I'm just coming down from the ceiling. And if I make a mistake, there's no one to help me. Cause a lot of Arachne's track is just, she's just up there by herself singing up in the really high, and there's no like scene partner that can like help you if you forget something. There's like nothing, you're completely alone. And just hanging in the darkness before you like enter from the ceiling, there's like 3 or 4 minutes where you just hang completely alone and looking down on your castmates who are doing their scenes. And it was, I struggled with a bit of stage fright hanging up there. Like, oh my God, what if I forget everything? and so that was like a trial by fire, I guess, in a way. Like, either you figure out how to deal with your brain in the dark or you don't. So I learned a lot of things from that show.
I've read that you always had the pull between music and acting. But you originally went to L.A. after school instead of New York. And I'm just curious about why the decision when you are so obviously natural and wonderful on stage that you went to LA, and then what finally got you here where you belong in New York?
Oh, well, thanks for saying that. When I was in Chicago, I fell in love with doing films. I'd done like a couple of indie films and some commercial work, and I was just really itching to do more films and maybe get into television as well. And so that brought me out to LA, that pursuit. And through a certain amount of like bad timings and bad luck, I wound up not really getting as far forward in that direction as I wanted to while I was there. But there's a vibrant theater community in LA, which I wasn't aware of before going there. So I just kept doing, while I was waiting to get where I wanted in the TV and film direction, I was just constantly doing theater because I love it. And it was still getting a way to work on my craft. And so I was still doing this thing that I love in LA, which seems strange that it would happen in LA, the theater. Spider-Man came, well, first was the phone call from Kate Wariski, who I'd worked with before, on a couple productions in, La Jolla at South Coast Rep, in South Coast Rep, in California. And, she called me and asked if I would come to New York and understudy the Miracle Worker. And I was like, oh my God, this is actually Broadway calling me. Like literally it's Broadway saying, come. And, you know, my mom would always say this thing, when Broadway calls, you answer. So I was like, well, I guess I got to go. So I packed up all my stuff and, you know, moved to New York to thinking, okay, this is now where I'm going to live. And that wound up not quite going that way. And so I came back to L.A. And then a few years passed and we're doing more theater and la, la, la. And then Spider-Man comes to Chicago and L.A. to audition for Replacements. And that's what brought me back to New York the second time, and here I am.
So Elizabeth Vincent Hill in the New York Times wrote a profile on you, and the headline was "Katrina Link Can Quietly Break Your Heart." were you ready for this type of reaction to the band's visit? At what point did you know that the band's visit was special?
To answer your first question, no, definitely not ready. I don't know, shows that you're in when you love them, I guess it's kind of like how you people feel about their kids. Like, my kid is the best kid. I love this kid. Everyone, you know, so I think everyone feels like their show is special, or the thing they're working on is special, or at least hopes that it is. Cause you kind of fall in love with all the shows that you work on, hopefully. Mostly.
you've taken two shows very quickly from off-Broadway to Broadway, both in Decent and the band's visit. Has it been different playing off-Broadway, Broadway, the responses from the audience, just the feeling?
Yes. With Indecent, we had enough experience with doing it in three other theaters with three different kinds of audiences before we brought it to Broadway. So I think we were sort of trained in, like, okay, this kind of audience might be like this. So it wasn't as unusual as it feels like the audiences off Broadway for a band's visit were pretty consistent. And then the Broadway audiences, they vary wildly, I think, in their reactions depending on the day and what's happening in the world. Also has changed since we did the band's visit off Broadway. Mm. So I think there's more variance in the Broadway audiences than the off-Broadway, but also the off-Broadway audience was very small. It was just a tiny, sure, you know, 200 seat theater, and this is over 1,000 people. So I guess, you know, that's a larger group of people that are coming. So of course there's going to be more variation, but.
And you guys went to Israel in between off-Broadway and Broadway?
Yes. Yeah.
How did that change or inform the performances and the production as a whole?
I think there's it was such a like extraordinary thing to get to do, to get to go to Israel and be in the town where the film was shot, and hang out with Eran Kalirin, the filmmaker, and we got to meet some of the cast of the film, and it was like you get an experiential knowledge of a place that before maybe you were only reading about or like doing as much research as you can, but you get to actually go there and things are like can be in your body and in your memory in a way that can only happen if you've been to the place. And of course it was a short amount of time. So it, you know, of course I'm no expert in what it's like to be there, but I have a definite, more specific sense memory. I think those of us that went there also got like a deeper sense of the place.
So Katrina, before you go, let's get a few biographical details out of you. You're from the Chicago area? Was that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah.
And where did you go to school?
Northwestern.
Oh, you went to Northwestern?
So you mean like high school?
Where did you grow up, and then where did you go to college? Yeah.
I grew up in the western burbs of Chicago, Barrington, and then went to Northwestern to study music, to study viola performance, actually.
Oh.
And my viola teacher was a professor there, and he's Peter Slowick. He was a fantastic teacher, and I wanted to continue studying with him. So I went to Northwestern and just couldn't stop doing theater. Couldn't stop doing theater and dance.
It's good. Were you in good theater school?
Oh, yeah. Were you in any WAMU shows?
I was just going to ask.
Yes. Yes, I think I did two of them. Yes, mm-hmm. The WAMU shows. Yes. And
brothers, sisters, family in the business, anything like that?
No, just me. My brother's an accountant, and my dad's like a computer guy, and but they always were very appreciative of music. My brother studied the cello when we were kids, so there was a lot of duets around the house. And crying because we did not want to do duets. so there was definitely always an appreciation and an encouragement and a support for the arts from my folks. So I'm very lucky.
You have a band called Moxie Finks. Tell us a little bit about that. Do you have time to keep working on this as the band's visit is ongoing?
She's on a little bit of a hiatus right now. She's kind of a persona, I guess, which sounds pretentious to say, but like she's a character, I guess. And it's like this, I write the music and do the arrangements, and usually it's me and my computer and my viola maybe and singing, but there's wigs and like some crazy costume changes and sort of shenanigans that happen in the set. So it's kind of like performance art, kind of storytelling, weird stuff. she's taking a break right now just because it does require a lot of brain space to put a show like that together. And the band's visit is a priority right now.
I love your description, calling yourself a bonkers lady on your about page. That made me laugh right away.
yeah.
So, Katrina, thank you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio to talk a little bit about what's going on in your life. We want to remind listeners that Ghostlight Records is putting out the CD for the band's visits coming online and in stores on Friday, February 23rd. And Katrina, thank you so much, and we hope to talk with you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is the park. It's not look like a park, you have to imagine. You see this is the grass, and there is where the children play, and this is the sea. Do you hear the sea?
Yes.
Tell me, Tufik, how does it feel to do music? To have the orchestra? How does it feel? To have all the people waiting for you and all the eyes for you and, you know?
Well, it's...
Yes, what?
A note to the listeners. We originally had Peter's review of Bernadette Peters in Hello, Dolly! Right here in this section, but we released it prematurely before the press date. We will put it back in the show this coming Thursday. If you want to download it and listen to it then, come on back. Okay, in the review section, so Jan, you got a chance to see Porto at the Women's Project, so tell us about that.
Porto is by the playwright Kate Benson, who I think is in her 30s. I'm pretty sure she's in her 30s because this is a rom-com for the millennial generation. It's a play set primarily in a bar in Brooklyn. And this young woman, her name is Porto. The title of the play is Porto, lowercase in brackets. And I still haven't figured out what that means. But Porto, the character, is kind of an everywoman. She's not overly attractive. She's not overly bright. She's just a really nice, genuine everywoman. And she comes into this bar just about every night, and she's well known there. Her friends come in and they hang out. And one night she meets a guy there who's a newcomer to the bar. And this is, because it's in Brooklyn, it's a really hipster bar. And because the playwright is Kate Benson, I saw a previous play of hers, which some people may remember. It's called A Beautiful Day in November on the Banks of the Greatest of the Great Lakes. And, excuse me, Benson likes to play with the form, and she likes to play with character names. And in Porto, the characters are named after what they do. There's a character named Doug the bartender, and everybody calls him Doug the bartender, Raphael the waiter. And the customers are named, with the exception of Porto, the customers are named for their drinks. Hennepin for the beer, Dry Sack for the sherry. And so they come in to this bar, and Porto strikes up what seems to be a fledgling relationship with Hennepin. And the question, of course, is whether or not a woman, a modern woman who has her own life and her own job, can she be in a relationship with a man without losing her identity? Throughout the play, Porto's thoughts are narrated by Kate Benson, the playwright, off stage. We don't see her until the curtain call, but there's a steady narration. As we go through the relationship with Porto and Hennepin, there is a scene where she's debating how she should respond to various actions of his, and all of a sudden we get two world-famous feminists. I'm vamping here because I'm trying to remember exactly who the two are. We get Gloria Steinem and Simone de Beauvoir. And they debate for her what positions she should take in the relationship. There are lots of references that I think people in the millennial generation would catch. And I think that's so because people around me, and there are a lot of young people in the theater, were laughing. I didn't get them. I'm not a millennial. And it wasn't really a play, again, that was aimed at me. And yet, primarily because of the performance of the woman who plays Porto, Julia Serna Frest is her name. She was just so genuine and so real in the role that I think, regardless of your demographic or your gender, you can identify with her and her vulnerability about whether to be open to this relationship and how to be open to this relationship. The play is amusingly directed by Lee Sunday Evans, and it's really imaginatively designed by Kristen Robinson. The audience is on the bartender's side of the bar, and so we see people sitting at the stools. We see the bartender fixing drinks, and then the sort of absurdist scene with Steinem and de Beauvoir. I'm going to leave that reveal for people who go to see it. I will say, though, that they are played by men, Simone de Beauvoir and Gloria Steinem. That puts sort of a spin on it that I'm still trying to figure out, because even after seeing the play, writing about it, thinking about it, I still don't know exactly where Kate Benson, the playwright, comes out on this continuum. But it's an entertaining evening.
You know, back in the 90s, Anne Bogart did a production of Kaufman and Hart's Once in a Lifetime at ART in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And she did something like this in the sense that she had somebody reading the stage directions. And I got the impression that Anne Bogart had read the play and said, you know, these stage directions are so funny themselves that I think that people should hear them. Was there any type of thing like that that was going on here, given that she was essentially reading stage directions? And
no, they're not stage directions.
Oh.
They're Porto's thoughts as she's trying to figure out. She's looking at this guy, talking to this guy, and then she's trying to figure out, you know, just as we do, we have these inner conversations. So it's not the stage directions.
Okay.
All right. So that is Porto down at the Women's Project. I'll have a link to that in the show notes if you'd like to keep checking that out.
Yeah, it's playing, let me just say quickly, it's playing through March 4th, and it's at the McGinn Casale Theater, which used to be the Promenade Theater. So it's uptown on 76th Street and Broadway.
That seems, in my memory, that theater has had a lot of names. I've seen a few things there. All right, Peter. You got a chance to see, I think it was a one-night-only concert of Thoroughly Modern Millie. So tell us about that.
Ooh.
This was Monday night, and it was a benefit for the Actors Fund. And it was very impressive how many of the original cast members were there. There were 30 people in the original cast. 22 were there. Now, what's really so Sutton Foster was there, yeah, and she was terrific, and she got a standing ovation the moment she stepped onto the stage. Yes, indeed, Mark Kudish was there. Yes, indeed, Gavin Creel was there. Sure, everybody of great importance was there. But what really impressed me was in the chorus, there was Kate Baldwin and Casey Nicola. Okay, because they were in the original cast, and little did they know what was in store for them. Now, it was really terrific of Kate Baldwin to show up. Think about it. She's working. She could have said, excuse me, guys, this is my one night off. I'd like to rest. But out of loyalty and out of gratitude, and, you know, there's something about going back to where you started and reliving that experience that is significant. So I think that was part of it as well. So too for Casey Nicola, who certainly, I don't know if anybody got paid, but he certainly doesn't need the money. And if you want proof of that, after all, his name is on the Book of Mormon, his name is on Aladdin, and his name is on the incoming Mean Girls. So so we don't have to take up a collection for Casey Nicola. So really, I thought it was terrific that they would show up and do it. What was so nice was that you could tell in the audience that there were people who were there who were living the experience they had, 16 years ago when Millie first happened, and they just loved having the experience all over again. And, of course, there were people who weren't theatergoers back then, maybe not even born then, who were having the wonderful time in experiencing going back in history and seeing so many of the original cast members. What was significant to me, well, there were lines that had so much irony packed into them. For example, Jimmy tells Billy, you've come a long way. Well, Lord, certainly Sutton Foster has, hasn't she? And this, of course, was her breakout role. Now, I don't know how many people know this, but she was actually the understudy when the show began in La Jolla. And the actress who was playing the role was having vocal problems that I'm going to take a day off, all right? And so Sutton had to do the show. And she didn't know the dialogue. She knew the songs. So she performed the songs and she held the script. And afterwards, nobody held that against her, because I am telling you that they said, Sutton, want to be the star of the show, which indeed she did. And so lines like that really did impress me tremendously, thinking what must be going through her head when she's hearing lines like that. Or you've made the team, as Trevor Graydon, Mark Kudish, said to her. So that was pretty amazing to me, thinking what a career she's had since then. And it might not have happened if indeed that actress had gone on, hadn't had vocal problems, you know. So, but that is indeed show business. So standing ovations galore after Forget About the Boy, after Gimme Gimme. Everybody had just such a wonderful time, and it was really packed. I mean, in fact, the day of the show, they contacted us and in the press and said, look, please, it's going to have to be a single ticket. It just is, because the demand for this is just so great. So please forgive us, but there's nothing we can do. The Actors Funds needs a seat. We understood. At least I did. I don't know about anybody else, frankly. But anyway, I understood. And, you know, it's so wonderful to go to one of these things. But when do you get a chance to see so much of the original cast? And the choreography, this wasn't just a concert. Yes, they carried scripts, and occasionally they needed them. But for the most part, it was a case where everybody was raring to go and ready to sing and dance and show us that Millie is a wonderfully good time. So I think a lot of people who are there will consider it one of the great nights in their theater going lives.
So much positive word of mouth got around about this thing. Is there any thought that you might think that we might see another?
No, I don't think it'll be with this cast, but nevertheless, I think that we haven't seen the last of Millie on Broadway, and that's fine with me. It is a joyous show, and it's very nice to have both contemporary songwriters mixed with songwriters of yore. I mean, the title song of Thoroughly Modern Millie, which got an Oscar nomination, is really terrific on so many levels. I mean, it's Criminal, What Women Will Do is a wonderful lyric. And This Is 1922 is a wonderful lyric, too, because the point is everybody thinks that the time they're living in, of course, is the most up-to-date time. You know, now we think of 1922 as quaint. It's almost 100 years ago. But when you're living in 1922, whoa, that's up-to-date. You know, so that's a very fine observation by Sammy Kahn. But of course, this is also, the score is also peppered occasionally with some operetta riffs, a bit of Our Sweet Mystery of Life, I'm Falling in Love with Someone, a Victor Herbert song from way back when. And you know, the audience went as crazy for these as they did for the other numbers. I mean, they just loved the operetta moments, even though if they were given a whole night of operetta, I don't think they would have such a good time. But in little doses, they really enjoyed it. I don't think we've had a successful operetta done in an operetta style. I'm not counting The Pirates of Penzance, which was spoofily directed, and that's not a complaint, since The Red Mill in 1945. You know, I think that was the last one that really ran for a while, and that was done in earnest. So to see, it was grandiose, don't misunderstand me, the operetta moments, but still, people went along with it and had such a good time and loved the excess of it. And then again, we had Harriet Harris again, which was really quite wonderful to see her playing that marvelous Mrs. Mears, and Shirley Ralph was there too as Muzzy, you know. So it really was great to see so many people. And by the way, I'll grant you I was in row U, but still, they didn't look older to me. It's as
Peter,
if
did they film this by any chance? This would be a great Broadway HD or something like that.
wouldn't it? I have no idea. Nobody mentioned that, so I don't know. But what a good point. It really would be such a nice thing, especially for people, as I say, who just missed it the first time around. Because Lord knows, in 16 years, there are a number of people who have become theater goers and who weren't back then. So so it really was a marvelous opportunity for them, too.
I mean, just think of the wicked Hamilton, Dear Evan Hansen fans that were not around when when that happened. We have to find out if Broadway HD or somebody else, Great Performances, PBS or something like
that. Yeah, someone.
That. If only we knew somebody at PBS. All right, let's continue on with the reviews. Jan, you got to see In the Body of the World, the new Eve Ensler play. So tell us about that.
This was a play that I was really looking forward to because it is another one-woman show by Eve Ensler, who created and performed for many years the Vagina Monologues, which have taken on a life of their own and even outside the theater, because it performed all over. They've sort of co-opted Valentine's Day as V-Day to encourage women to be comfortable with their bodies, to be able to talk about their bodies, express themselves in this way. This play had been marketed as a play about Eve's work. And she has gone around the world and has become a real advocate for women, particularly women in third world countries. And this play was marketed as being in part about her experiences working with women in the Congo, and people who have seen plays like Ruined what is the Denai Guerrero play that I'm blocking that was at the Public a few years ago? Also about women in these war-ravaged countries where rape is used as a weapon. And I was looking forward to that. However, during the process of her work in the actual Congo with women who are recovering from these experiences, Ensler was diagnosed with cancer. And the play actually is more about her experience going through cancer. And it's an experience that I think she is still working through. And so she takes the audience almost beat by beat through her experience, almost as though this were a therapy session. And I found it very uncomfortable. And I feel uncomfortable saying that, because here's a woman who is a cancer survivor, and she is clearly determined to go on with her life. But I found it, you know, TMI, too much information. We go through her chemo and the side effects of the chemo. There are attempts to draw a comparison between what's happening with her body and what's happening with the bodies of the women in Africa, but I found that uncomfortable too. It was a play that made me very itchy the entire time I was there, and I actually could not wait to get out of the theater. It was not an enjoyable and theater doesn't always have to be consoling, enjoyable, but I didn't find it enlightening. either. I just felt as though I were part of her therapeutic process. I don't know. Peter, I know you've seen it too. What was your experience with it?
Well, it's so funny you mentioned the thing about the Congo, because that was my impression going in too. And I thought, oh, maybe I missed that in the press release. I guess I didn't know it was going to be about her experiences with cancer and chemotherapy. But I'm somewhat glad to hear that you just have you say that, because now I guess I didn't quite miss that in the press release, or at least I'm inferring that. But I understand exactly where you're coming from on all this. And I will admit that this is not something to take out your steady on a Saturday night and have a good rollicking time. But on its own terms, for what it is, I thought it was quite effective. And Lord knows what's in store for us all. And I do know that so many people, when they have something terrible happen to them health-wise, feel the need to talk about it, and talk about it quite a bit. And you might say, well, fine, then have her do it with her friends. You know, don't have her charge umpteen dollars. Would that it were teen dollars. But anyway, a lot of money to come and hear her problems. But one also has to admit, you know, she's quite brave in the matter-of-fact way that she delivers it. And, you know, for somebody who in photographs as someone who looks a little severe, I was surprised to see how charming she was and how endearing she was in, and very good connection with the audience at the beginning of the play, before we knew any of this was going to happen. And there are some literally revealing moments that are very I'm not going to give away what the revealing moment is, but it was very surprising to me. So I cannot disagree with a syllable of what you've said, but I do feel that there is something else there that may be of help to people who are going through this as well. I remember there was a play, I never saw it, but I remember there was a play in New Jersey called Chemo Buddies, and it was written by a woman who did later die, I'm sorry to say, of breast cancer. And I know that while she's sitting in the waiting room and she's a playwright, she's saying to herself, there's a play here. You know, of course there is. You know, whether or not it's something people want to see is another story, and I'll grant you that. And I can certainly understand why you were uncomfortable. But I certainly also thought about the fact that if this were to happen to me, if I were to get this disease, would I be as brave as this lady has been? Or at least, you know, maybe she's had many, many moments of going crazy and screaming and why me and all that kind of stuff. But we didn't quite get that. And so I was impressed by the way she dealt with it.
I guess if I knew what I was going into.
I know. Yep.
Yeah. And so I felt uncomfortable with that. And a very good friend has just been diagnosed. And so I sat there feeling you know, sort of whiplashed back and forth. And there's also, you talk about her engagement with the audience. There, at least at my performance, there was a little bit of audience participation that I felt just was, I don't know, coercive. And I refused to participate. So
I did too. By the way, in case you're saying to yourself, here's Manhattan Theater Club trying to save a buck, a one-person show. You know, there's no set. Well, as it turns out, there is a set, which turns out to be quite a surprise as well. So we can't really criticize Lynn and Barry for trying to save a buck. In fact, one could effectively argue they went overboard in giving Eve Ensler what she wanted, obviously, for a set, because there was no expense spared at one point in this play, was there?
True. Absolutely true.
What a surprise that was, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was a little bit surreal.
Yes, indeed.
So I haven't seen this, but all I can think of was that the entire set they built for the opening of the revival of Funny Thing Happened Away to the Forum with Nathan Lane when they did the tragedy comedy tonight. That 10-second gag that they built the whole set for.
You know? Sure.
All right, so that is We will have we'll have a link to In the Body of the World in the show notes if you want to check that out. Peter, you got over to Atlantic Theater Company to see Hangman, Martin McDonagh's new show. It's a Royal Court Theater production. That's the premiere. So tell us about that.
Well, this is the one playwright who really excites me. And whenever Martin McDonagh writes a play and I know that I'm going to see it, I count the days like a kid till Christmas. And more than that, it's a case where I really, really, really get so excited when I walk into the theater. And he rarely disappoints me. And he certainly did not disappoint me at this point in time with this new play. Now, I will say that I have certainly heard a lot of people say, well, it's not top-notch McDonagh. And I will admit that the end of the play has a device that is essentially the same that he used in one of his earlier masterpieces. Yes, masterpieces. But that said, this is a play that is rollickingly funny. And I think we really need to get a darker color than black to really define black comedy as seen through the eyes of Martin McDonagh. I mean, here's a convicted man who's about to face the noose. And what does he do? Among other things, yes, he claims he's innocent. And frankly, I think he is. But that's left to the theater goer. But there he is facing the noose. And he complains that he won't be executed by the country's chief hangman, but he's been assigned to the second stringer. I mean, you know, that's such a wild perception. Who else would think of that but Martin McDonagh? You know, so he's got a crazy brain. And I mean that as a compliment. If anybody else has this much imagination, all I can say is this person is not writing plays, because I don't see anybody like Martin McDonagh, who really the term sui generis applies tremendously. And so it is about this guy who finds himself out of work when hanging is abolished in England. So he opens a pub. But the thing is, he still has the self-importance that he had as this man who literally was killing people. And that does a job on you in a certain way. I mean, we never get the impression, never whatsoever, get the impression that Harry Wade, the name of the hangman, is somebody who is particularly bothered by the fact that he is killing people. It's all in a day's work. He's very matter of fact about it. But he carries that over into the rest of his life. And we wonder if he's going to, you should pardon the expression, hang himself. And I mean that in the metaphorical sense, as the play goes on, because suddenly somebody comes into the bar who threatens him. I don't mean threatens him literally with words, but just the fact that he comes from London makes Harry stare him down, because he's in Lancashire. And of course, he feels a little he feels like a second stringer in that way, too, that he's not living in London. So he doesn't like this guy. And this guy will turn out to give him much, much grief as time goes on. And it's really wonderful that Johnny Flynn plays this guy named Peter, who really has that look back in anger, angry young man persona that was really happening in Britain during the early 60s when the play takes place. So it's very impressive in that way. But the funny parts, I mean, yeah, Harry is interviewed by a newspaper man and who points out that he is the second stringer, that a guy named Pierpoint was really the guy who executed many more people than he did. And Harry points out that, well, yeah, but I mean, he was around when World War II was happening, and he got to execute all those war criminals. So, you know, if I were around then, you know, I would have been able to do more, you know, but I think there should be an asterisk next to his name. And for those of us who know baseball and remember or have heard about Roger Maris getting an asterisk next to his name for hitting 61 home runs, but in a season that had 8 games longer than Babe Ruth's 60 home runs, that there was all this talk about an asterisk next to his name. To think of it in terms of hangman, I mean, it's just hilarious. So believe me, it gets gruesome. And there is a use of a chair that has been the most interesting since Ionesco wrote his play. So I can only say that even though the Atlantic run is sold out, and I'm telling you, I don't think I've seen so many people in front of an off-Broadway theater looking for tickets, you know, seeing me walk up the street alone and hoping that that nobody's going to join me. I got asked for tickets for this more than any other off-Broadway show in recent memory. And yeah, so I'm very, very glad that it seems to be moving to the Court Theater on Broadway. Mm-hmm. That will give certainly many, many more people opportunity to see the play, which I think they should. Gruesome, not as gruesome as other McDonough plays. No, no, no. In fact, the most gruesome thing that happens in this play is done so subtly that I'm telling you, this guy's really wonderful. We're very lucky to be living in an era. And welcome back, Martin McDonough, because you haven't done many plays in recent years because, of course, you've been doing movies. And, of course, your Three Billboards movie is terrific, too. And I wish you well at the Oscars. And I hope it happens because I think you certainly deserve that. And welcome back.
All right.
Julie, are you a McDonough fan?
I don't know his work, actually. I don't see a lot of plays. I do more musicals.
Have you seen Three Billboards?
I have not.
I'm just wondering if he's a guy's playwright.
Oh, because you don't respond to him?
I don't. Uh-huh. I'm going to see, and I'm very grateful that I'm going to see Hangman, because, as you say, it's such a hot ticket. I'm going week after next. The guys I know, the men I know, just really respond to him, and I'm a little more foot draggy about him.
I'm seeing it March 6th, and Jan, I have not responded well to Martin McDonagh in the past.
Oh, so it's not a gender thing. Okay.
Maybe I should see a doctor. Yeah.
Dr. Doolittle?
I love the score to Dr. Doolittle. Anyway, go on.
But you mentioned Three Billboards, and there was rumor this week that Three Billboards, they're looking to adapt it for the stage. So,
really?
So that would be interesting, although as my topic of discussion with Matt Tamanini on Today on Broadway is where would they put it with all these long running shows? We seem to have less and less opportunities to get new works into the theaters. But Matt assures me with his trusty spreadsheet that there will be theaters available.
So, oh, it's color coded.
It is. Matt's spreadsheet is totally the thing.
It's so painful to look to that space to the left of the Imperial and see nothing there when there was once a theater there before that parking garage was there. Mm-hmm. So, boy, 45th Street could have used another theater, certainly, and something would be playing there now. So it is really too bad. Nobody knew when all those theaters were down.
Let me ask you guys, you know how when we say London's West End, it's kind of like theaters are everywhere in London. Okay,
that's true.
When we talk about Broadway, we're talking about 41st to 59th Street, 6th Avenue to 10th Avenue type of thing. I mean, certainly there could be a 1,800 seat theater put, you know, in many of the places of New York City that we could, in essence, call Broadway. And with the changes down at BAM, you know, perhaps BAM will become an unofficial Broadway house.
Certainly did that with the Vivian Beaumont. Do either of you know how they were able to persuade the Broadway League to certify the Vivian Beaumont, which is up on 65th and Broadway, as a Broadway house?
It's a matter of seats, isn't it?
That's exactly what it is. It's a matter of seats. Yeah. Ironically enough, before the Beaumont happened, the Lincoln Center Repertory Theater was ensconced downtown at West 4th Street at a theater called the Anta Washington Square. It's now a part of NYU, but it was part of NYU then. But I mean, it's now an NYU building. They tore it down entirely. In fact, Trinity Repertory in Providence bought the building, and we're going to reconstruct the theater there. But my point is, that was considered Broadway, even though it was nowhere in the Broadway district. So it does have to do with seating capacity. And of course, shows that used to be at the theater on 2nd Avenue, where Best Little Whorehouse started, where Grease started. It had a number of names like the Eden and the Intermediate and a few others as well. Mm-hmm. So it really has to do with that more than anything else. If you're over 500 seats, you're a Broadway show. So what's really sad is the Ziegfeld Theater. Yeah.
The Madison Square Garden shows haven't been really considered Broadway in that garden.
Oh, that's true, isn't it? Yes. Yeah, so obviously contracts come into play as well. So, but a very good rebuttal, James. I don't know the story behind that. But it's too bad the Ziegfeld Theater, I don't mean the original Ziegfeld Theater, which was torn down in 1965, but the movie theater, obviously, I mean, couldn't something have happened there? I passed by the other day, and it's now the Ziegfeld Ballroom. So, but it could have been the Ziegfeld Theater, I would think, with not that much money, of course, millions, but you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. It had to be cheaper than starting from scratch. It just had to be. And I guess people were just afraid that people wouldn't be able to find it, which was one of the reasons why the original Ziegfeld Theater fell into great disuse, because it was off the beaten track. And there used to be a theater right off 6th Avenue on 54th Street, fittingly enough, for the longest time, called the 54th Street Theater. And even that was considered just too far away. And that's where shows that were doomed, everybody thought were terrible, or shows, long-running shows, would go to die, like Damn Yankees and Bye Bye Birdie went there. Do-Re-Mi did, too. So, you know, it's too bad. I really do believe that if it's a hit show, people will find it, just as they found Man of La Mancha down at that into Washington Square. It didn't suffer from being there. In fact, it profited from it because it was a different type of staging. It was more of a regional theater type of look of a show, and New York hadn't seen it. And I really believe that was greatly important to Man of La Mancha's original success. So, yes, we do need new ones. And I'm sorry that 46th Street area on 8th Avenue, which we heard for the longest time was going to be built into a theater by the Schuberts, doesn't seem to be happening. But boy,
we have a handful of theaters in Midtown that I can think of. The Hammerstein Ballroom, you have the Ed Sullivan Theater, you have the Rose Ballroom in back of the Ed Sullivan Theater that was just torn down and could have been a theater there. But also between 125th Street to 181st Street, there are a handful of theaters that occasionally do legit shows but are not considered Broadway theaters. But it's something for us to think about as we have this embarrassment of the riches of where lots of shows are looking to come in and can't come in because of real estate. Anyway, the last review of the morning is Bar Mitzvah Boy. I don't have any information on this, Peter, so why don't you take it away?
This is a 1978 musical by Julie Stein and Don Black, based on Jack Rosenthal's teleplay. It was only a 75-minute teleplay done in England on the BBC. And if you know the third play of Plaza Suite, where the girl will not come out of the bathroom to get married, there is a similarity, because here's a boy who's going to be bar mitzvahed by his working-class family. The father drives a cab. I don't think the mother works. And they've been planning for months, of course. They've spent a lot of money, so on and so forth. And just about as he's about to be bar mitzvahed, he runs away. He will not be bar mitzvahed. And the reason he decides not to be bar mitzvahed is very, very telling and very impressive. He's not wrong with the reason he gives. I'm not going to give it away, but it's quite a perception. And I remember when I saw the original teleplay, I literally went, wow, when he said what he said. That really made the impression on me. All right, so it became a musical. It was directed by Martin Charnin, who was flying high, because this was shortly after Annie. And, you know, Julie Stein was still a force in musical theater then. Don Black is certainly no slouch as a lyricist, and I think these These are his best lyrics ever. I think it's a terrific show. I'm sorry it never got to Broadway. It was announced for the Minskoff Theater in 1979. It was going to open on Halloween. I remember that vividly. But it didn't happen because the show only ran 77 performances in London. It deserves much better, and I'm so glad that Mufti is giving it a chance. Of course, Julie Stein is somebody who's brassy Broadway. If you know the Overture to Gypsy, and if you don't, I'm very surprised you're listening. The Overture to Funny Girl, which I even think is better. That's a minority opinion, God knows. But Julie Stein was famous for these brassy overtures and Dick Perry playing that trumpet that you could actually see gleaming when you were in the theater, especially when he stood during the Overture to Gypsy and played those wonderful burlesque riffs. So here you lose that, of course, at Mufti because you're dealing with a piano. So it's not quite the ideal situation for a Julie Stein score. That said, it really is quite terrific. And while we miss the brass, we certainly get the story and we get the music and lyrics. I will say that this is a revised version by David Thompson, and I'm not saying he did a bad job. I'm not saying that for a tenth of a second, but I am sorry that some songs that I'm very, very fond of have gone by the wayside, and songs that were dropped along the way, which I don't think are as good as the original, did come in. So, but still, this is definitely worth seeing. It was done about 30 years ago in some theater on the East Side, and it even changed its name to something like Songs for a Saturday Night, I think it was called. Mark Gottfried, the critic, adapted it then and set it in Brooklyn, which I don't think was a bad idea, actually. But anyway, here we have it in its original setting of London. I really do feel you get over there. I'm not going to say that you're going to have the greatest time of your life, but I do think this is a musical worth paying attention to. And certainly you're going to be tremendously impressed by the cast. There's not a weak link among them. And of course, you do need a young man to play this part. What's wonderful is the young man whose first name is Peyton, and I'm sorry I forgot his last name, something like Musk. But anyway, that he was really terrific in dominating the proceedings. And even though the Muftis, they carry around scripts and scores because they are glorified readings, he didn't look at it once. You know, it's so wonderful to be a kid when your memory is still great and you're spongy in that way that you pick up everything. So it's a performance well worth seeing. And so is Tim Jerome in the cast, who's really quite wonderful, and Ben Fankhauser, who has a terrific song. They're all good songs from the London cast album. If you have that album, and I urge you to find it somewhere, because it really is a stellar recording. I could recommend Bar Mitzvah Boy.
All right. So before we wrap up for today, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in Apple Podcasts. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is iHeartRadio plays us. TuneIn plays us. Stitcher plays us. Google Play. Anywhere that you can get finer podcasts, you can find Broadway Radio. Contact information for Peter, for Jan, for Julie, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Yeah, the question was, a novel in the 30s was made into a film in the 50s, but there the sex of the protagonist was changed from a man to a woman. When the musical version of the novel opened in the 60s, the protagonist was a man again, but a woman wound up stealing the show. What's the name of the property that never changed, the woman who stole the show? Well, I'm talking about Jerome Wideman's I Can Get It For You Wholesale, which had Harry Bogan as its anti-hero in the novel. But for the 1951 film, Susan Heywood was playing the character who was renamed Harriet Boyd. It was back to Harry Bogan for the musical, where Elliot Gould played him. While he was at it, he fell in love with the woman who stole the show from him, Barbara Streisand. So Doug Strassler was the first to get it, followed by Jack Leshner and Stephen Bell. This week's question, what do these Tony-nominated Best Musical losers have in common? La Plume de Matante, Ilya Darling, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Black and Blue, Miss Saigon, Wicked, and Something Rotten. All nominated for Best Musical. None of them won, but what do they all have in common beyond that?
Okay. Well, if you have an answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, Jan Simpson, and Julie Musbach, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.